Thanks everybody for joining us. I'm here today with renowned author, founder of Wellings Capital, and my dear friend Paul Moore. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey Matt, what a great honor to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're gonna have a good time today. Want the listeners to understand a little bit about your background, our relationship, and how you came about forming Wellings Capital. So with that, let's start from the beginning. I know that I know a little bit about you, and I know you're a Golden Gloves winner from Dayton, Ohio, originally. But tell me
Nice.
about your background. How does a boxer go to being a fund-of-fund manager?
Yeah, well, I tell you, how does a boxer become a guy who gets a bobblehead? That's the question. So, the truth is, so I got an engineering degree, which was my first mistake, and then I got an MBA, which probably wasn't a mistake. I went to Ford Motor Company. I really enjoyed it there. But I found myself within 6 months, even though I had thought planned to work there 30 years, I started planning entrepreneurial side gigs. And I thought, maybe I should do something else. So a buddy of mine who also went to Ohio State and Ford, and I started planning and strategizing, and finally, after multiple tries, we started a staffing firm. And about 5 years into Ford, I quit. And we just had a perfect, just very, everything was providentially wonderful in this company. And we had about 70 clients, 100% client retention. 5 years in, we sold to a small public firm. And I thought, hey, I'm a full-time investor now. And Matt, I wasn't. I hadn't read Buffett. I hadn't really studied investing. And I was honestly a full-time speculator, is what I was. And I had
You
a
had the
couple million.
entrepreneurial gene, though. I mean, it was in your blood from the beginning, it sounds like.
In all seriousness, I was an entrepreneurial investor, and basically that to me, Matt, means that I tried to get the same thrill and fun and joy out of investing that I did out of being an entrepreneur. I literally thought that I should. And so I was excited about investing. But Paul Samuelson is the first Nobel Peace Prize winner in economics from the US. And he said investing should be boring. It should be like watching paint dry or watching grass grow. If you want excitement, take $800 and go to the strip at Las Vegas.
Well, perfect, very fitting with us being in Las Vegas, but I'll tell you, what you and I do is very different than rolling dice, isn't it?
That's for sure. And it took me years to realize this. I didn't know that, generally, Matt, I think that, investing is when your principal is protected or potentially protected, and you've got a chance to make a return. Speculating is when your principal's not safe at all and not based on any fundamental principles, and you've got a chance to make a return. And, investing is beautiful. I love investing because it's creating true wealth. True wealth isn't a fancy car or a yacht. It's having assets that reliably produce cash flow. Warren Buffett said, if you don't learn to make money while you sleep, you'll have to work until you die. And true investors make money while they sleep.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I know you and I are admirers and followers of Buffett, and we've built that into both of our investment philosophies. But rewind back to Ford Motor Company, you had your staffing business, and you had this entrepreneurial gene inside of you. And at the same time, you wanted to be a great investor. How did you bridge the gap from the creativity side of being an entrepreneur to the slow process of watching paint dry, clipping out great returns year after year, mailbox money, as we call it in the business. How did you kind of bridge the gap there and get to from where you were back at Ford Motor Company and your staffing company to the formation of Wellings Capital? Kind of give us a glimpse of that journey and how that evolved.
Yeah, that was about a 15-year journey from about 1999 to 2014. I started flipping houses, and then I flipped waterfront lots at a beautiful resort like you have Tahoe, we have Smith Mountain Lake. And we started flipping houses, and then lots, and I built some houses, and I realized I was making money at each one of those transactions, but I was plowing a lot of it right back into the next one, and there was not really any cash flow being thrown off. And I had some other companies during that time, and honestly, I wasn't making money while I slept so much. And so in 2011, we built a multifamily facility and then another one in oil country in North Dakota. And we started printing money from this multifamily, which is basically a man camp for, you know, high priced apartments for oil workers. And we sold that company, and that was great. And I was happy to do that, but it gave me a taste for what this could be like. So we actually started a multifamily syndication firm, 2014, 2015. And Matt, you know, I wrote a book, you may not know this, but a humbly titled book called The Perfect Investment about multifamily. And you know what? A couple of years later, after banging our head up against the wall, I know I don't look it, but I was in my mid-50s, and I know I look 70, but seriously.
You look like you're in your mid-50s right now.
I know. I was like, I was probably actually only 50 at the time, and I was like, you know, I'm not going to take these risks anymore. I'm not going to roll the dice. I'm not going to pay 20 or 30% more than these apartments are worth and bank on, you know, the floating rate debt to always stay at this low number, to bank on trees always growing to the sky, as Howard Marks says, which, you know, they never do, which would be rents going up, you know, 10% a year indefinitely. I'm not going to bank on operating costs going down and vacancy going down and all these things, you know. And
it's overly optimistic underwriting assumptions, which
some
operators in our business unfortunately follow and end up getting hurt.
Yeah. I mean, we were bidding against multifamily syndicators who were in junior high school during the great financial crisis. And Matt, I'm serious, there's nothing wrong with being in junior high school in 2008. But the point is, they were raising tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and they were outbidding everybody. And, you know, if to be super honest here, we all know what happened to people like Tides Equities, who amassed $6 billion in multifamily assets at around age 30. And they were literally proclaimed like the up and coming heroes of multifamily in November of 22 in a big article. That same publication by February of 23 said they were about to lose everything. And of course they have. And we were bidding against them. So we decided we're done. So we pulled out, we revamped Wellings Capital after 4 years of beating our head up against the wall. And we decided we wanted to invest in a portfolio of recession resistant assets with the very best operators we could find in self storage and mobile home parks. And then later we expanded into four other asset types.
So that's an unbelievable story. Let me ask you, how did you fall on mobile home parks and self-storage? What about them was intriguing to you? What made you attracted to them? And when you saw them for the first time or underwrote those deals, why did you say, hey, this is where I want to build my business model around?
Well, one of the things I learned from Buffett was, you know, look for boring assets. And there's not much more boring, anything more boring than four pieces of sheet metal, a floor, and a door.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know it. It has some rivets, but still,
Fair point. It's boring.
And, you know, mobile home parks, they're not necessarily boring, but they're something that everybody looked down their nose at, except, of course, Sam Zell, who spent 40 or 50 years, 60 years amassing 158,000 mobile home park pads, quietly becoming a multi-billionaire doing it. And
one of the best performing REITs of all time, by the way, Equity Lifestyle.
Right. Yeah, right. And so we looked at self-storage and said, think about it. In multifamily, if I raise the rates 10%, this was back when they used to raise rents like 2% a year. If I raise the rates 10%, you know, somebody who's paying $1,200 a month might move out rather than pay an extra $120 a month for this apartment, you know, be on the hook for $14,000 a year in extra payment, or $1,400 extra a year in payments. But if they have a self-storage, you know, locker, if, as I called it at the time, a self-storage, you know, unit with us, and I raise their $120 a month rent by 10%, they're probably not going to spend a weekend, get a U-Haul, get their friends together, waste all that time to move down the street to save 12 bucks a month, especially when it's a month-to-month lease.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing that struck me.
Absolutely. I would say we call it a nuisance in this, to your point, to go get a U-Haul, move down the street. And by the way, what happens when the guy down the street goes up 10 or 15%?
Exactly.
So, well, let me ask you this question, and I commend you on picking two, in my opinion, and this is a little bit biased, the best asset classes out there. But what made you go down the path of being a fund of funds, looking for great operators versus being an operator yourself? And maybe you could just fill us all in on the distinction between the two.
Yeah, a little background on that. Mark Cuban, who I don't necessarily admire a lot, but he said diversification is for idiots. And Warren Buffett, one of our heroes, said diversification is pretty much for someone who doesn't really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I was upset about that because I was writing a book on Warren Buffett's principles for real estate investors. And then I realized, wait a minute, Warren Buffett's only got 28 or so people in his office, and he's a Fortune 7 company. He's the most highly diversified company. So wait a minute, what am I seeing wrong here? And then I realized the diversification was within a specialty. In other words, if, let's say, Dairy Queen, that's owned by Berkshire Hathaway, I believe.
Yes,
Dairy Queen, you know, let's say they decided, we're not just going to make ice cream. We're going to go ahead and make the cartons that the ice cream and the cones and the paper cups and the wax on the cups. And we're going to buy millions of acres of timberland to cut it down to make pulp. And we're going to make every dollar we can out of selling stuff at Dairy Queen. That would be, in my opinion, dumb diversification, the kind Buffett and Cuban are criticizing. But to have Buffett-style diversification, where you're a company with 28 staff people, no economists, by the way, and you're having about, I think it's 108 companies you own or have a piece of, that's smart diversification. We thought, hey, that's what we want. That's what our investors need, a way to, you know, go to one-stop shop, if you will, who does deep, deep due diligence, puts our own money into deals, and then allows them to write one check and get a piece of, let's say, 108 deals. And that's what we wanted to do. We also realized there is no way, in a related thought, there's no way we can become an expert in three things or six things or whatever. We can maybe over decades become an expert in one. How are we going to do self-storage, mobile home parks, multifamily, RV parks, other things? And so we decided to become a fund who hand selects the very best operators and deals we can in multiple asset classes, multiple geographies, and even multiple places in the capital stack.
Well, I got to hand it to you. You've done a tremendous job, and I think you've picked some fantastic sponsors. And in that same vein, perhaps you could kind of give us a little insight on that vetting process, how you pick the best in class, as we like to call it, sponsors in each industry that you're invested in. What does that process look like?
Yeah, it was my partner, Ben, and I originally doing due diligence, and we made some big mistakes up front, which I could circle back to. That was back in the teens. We came down to a 27-point due diligence process. And we look at the operator's character. Unlike Buffett in this one case, we look more at the jockey than the horse. We look very, very carefully at the management team,
okay,
at their ethics, at the way they look at debt, the way they look at, specifically floating rate debt.
Okay.
what type of leverage, what type of risks they're taking, what kind of underwriting. Do they have an experienced team that's all generally in, at least some of them generally in one headquarters location together, not all working from their homes in 40 different states? We look at the way they talk about their employees and their investors. We do a very deep dive online to find everything we can out about every one of their key principles. We spend a lot of money doing background and reference and criminal checks. Matt, not on you guys, we've never done this, but with our new sponsors, we're often doing net operating income audits so they can, we and they can prove exactly where the income is coming from that's being represented in a new acquisition. And sometimes we found some really troubling things in those, but there's a lot of steps in this. It takes months typically to vet a sponsor, and then we start looking at the deal.
Well, you said a couple things that kind of stood out to me. It's number one, you look more at the jockey than the horse. And number two is you really take a deep dive and take a look at their character. Let me ask you this question. What makes you want to get involved with a sponsor based off of their character? And what makes you run the other direction?
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as their character, we're looking for high ethics. We're looking for, somebody said, look at somebody and ask yourself, would you want to be in trouble? Would you want to be in a bad deal with this person for a whole decade? Because that could happen.
Sure.
And is this the kind of person you'd want to? Don't look at just how well things have turned out in the past or will. Look at how bad things could turn out and then ask yourself. And then this is sort of intangible, Matt, but we look at our gut. We check our gut. Does our gut telling us something's wrong here? I'm not saying that's the first thing we look at, but we ask ourselves that over the years. Buffett says the best investors say no a lot. The very best say no almost all the time. And so we have a default of saying no to the operator and the deal unless they can jump through a lot of hoops, a lot of hurdles to prove that we should invest with them. As far as the ones we say no to, I mean, there's several that stand out. One, we were 2 years ago, I think, we were at closing. We had wired the money for closing for a mobile home park. And I hate to admit this, I've never admitted it before, but I had a gut feel something was wrong. But we did enough due diligence that everything checked out so well that I just finally ignored it. And I'm kind of sad to admit that. But at closing, we wired the money and they changed the terms. They literally sent us a whole change in the way they were going to pay us out and the waterfall and everything. And they literally thought they could pull it off.
After they got the funds?
Well, after we wired to the title company, thankfully. And of course, that was it. We pulled out. I mean, we had done a lot of time on that deal. I had flown down to a southern state, let's say that. And, spent time there. And that was an obvious example. But, we already had investor money teed up, well, wired. And it would have been very easy just to go, okay, we can overlook this one thing. But that would have been a really bad idea. Another mistake we made really early on years ago was trusting, somebody said that they had sold a previous portfolio to Blackstone, but it was extremely confidential and they couldn't disclose anything about that sale at all. We should have dug deeper. We should have gotten more proof. We actually invested with them and, it's probably going to turn out okay, but we, 2 years ago, we started really, really giving them honestly a hard time about showing us more transparency in their financials. And we irritated them so much that they got their attorney involved. And that made us even more upset. So 16 or 18 months into this, after we started really, you know, like poking them, they finally made us an offer to buy us out, like just to give us our money back with no profit, of course.
Yeah.
And we happily took it and reinvested it somewhere else, including with you, by the way.
Yeah.
And that was, again, going back to a mistake we made, trusting that they had really sold to Blackstone. Maybe they did, but I kind of doubt it. Now, you know, it's really important to do a pre-mortem and go 10 years into the future and look back at today and say, what could I have missed? Let's assume this deal went totally south. What did I miss? And you ask yourself, oh, yeah, I should really look closer at that Blackstone comment, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Instincts are huge, aren't they? I mean, yeah. It's one thing to do your financial models and your due diligence, which obviously we have to do. You've got to check the boxes and make sure that deal makes sense from a financial perspective. I know you have an investment committee that you have to go through.
We do.
But there's nothing like when your gut tells you to go or to run the other direction. And in most cases, if not all, and I'm sure you could attest to this, just speaking from my own personal experience, whenever I don't follow my gut, I always kick myself.
Yep, that's it. That's right.
Isn't it amazing? Some of the best investors out there, like, but you know, we talk about Buffett all the time, and it's amazing to me how almost everything's done in his head. Almost everything's done with a handshake. And I think it's all done, 90% of that is just his instincts, pattern recognition over the years. You know, from doing this for 60, 70 years, you start to recognize patterns, and he could see around corners and see things that others can't. I like to think that you and I, the longer we're in this industry, in this business, we start to pick up on these patterns.
Yeah.
We see things that some of the people just getting into this business don't see as clearly, and it really allows us to outperform and deliver alpha to our investors.
I personally think that we were created by God to recognize things that our brain doesn't recognize. In other words, I've heard there are 2,000 or 3,000 signals that our gut, so to speak, can, our subconscious can see. And when we see those, it triggers our gut response, but we can't tangibly say, I don't trust this person. And interestingly, I think, don't tell her I said it, I think my wife is much better at picking these things up than I am.
Well, that's why it takes two to tango. You guys make a beautiful couple, and you know, that's the unity of marriage, right?
Yeah, right.
How long have you been married, by the way?
What time is it now? No, 38 years.
Congratulations. Any advice for us out there that want to be married for 38 years?
Oh, here's a couple things. Number one, the pain you're in. I remember standing at a payphone booth crying in the rain, calling my friend, why did you let me marry her? Why did you let her marry me? It's been awful. The pain you're in year 2, 3, 4, 5 is likely, if you stick with it, going to be totally resolved. And you're likely going to be totally, well, much happier by year 10 or 15. So stick with it through those hard years. It is so important. And that's a simple thing. Another practical daily tip is, you know, Ephesians in the Bible says, don't let the sun go down on your anger, meaning don't go to bed angry. I've done it a few times, and man, the morning, it was much worse. I don't know why.
It's not worth it. And when you look back, these things seem so minuscule in the big scheme of things. What were we even angry about at the end?
Yeah, I know.
I think it says something to be married for 38 years. It talks about commitment, discipline, the ability to stick with something when you make a commitment to ride it out, no matter what, through thick and thin. And I think there's a lot of parallels to investing. You know, this is a, like we discussed, this is a very long-term game. This isn't rolling the dice down on the strip in Las Vegas. Some of these investments we're married to for 10 years, and those sponsors and operators, back to character, you know, one wrong investment that doesn't go the way they want, when you just pull the cord and let that thing go, investors' capital is at stake. So I could see why you really, really harp on capital, or harp on characteristics and the character of the sponsor, perhaps even more so than the investment.
Yeah, right. That's true. And I hope we always do. So far, we keep building our team and we keep telling them, and we're hiring people that already believe that way.
What percentage of potential sponsors or GPs that you interview or vet or underwrite do you not invest with? Like, what would you say the ratio between investing versus not investing would be?
Yeah, in 2023, we looked at 515 and invested in 11. So it was a 1 or 2% we invested in.
Wow.
2024, we looked at 745 deals and we invested in 5. So we
Wow.
invested in 0.66%.
That's incredible. How do you even have the time to vet 744 potential candidates?
Well, the truth is, some of them just come across our desk and it's about 5 minutes till we pass on those.
Okay.
But like I told you, some of them are like the deal that I went to down south to see where we spend 2 months on it. So we just, that's a part of our team that we've built. I mean, our investment decision team, if you will, is twice as large as our capital raising team. In other words, that would be like for you in your world, that would be your asset management team being larger than your capital raising team. And that's, we just have to, I mean, honestly, we could probably add another person. And we just have to keep focusing on that. We cannot cut corners. Warren Buffett said that many, many investors over the years have found out that an impressive long string of big profit numbers multiplied by one single zero always equals zero.
Yeah. Speaking of team, which by the way, I think is absolutely huge to one's success in investing and in life for that matter. What tell me about the Wellings Capital culture and how not only how you selected your GPs, but Ben, you and Ben, who is your partner, how did you select your investment committee, your board, your CFO, and some of the other members on your team that have allowed you to deliver the returns that you have?
Yeah, we've looked more at character, work ethic, their drive and all that than we have experience. I think we've all learned that some people with great amount of experience in the exact right position, who've made a few job moves, many job moves, they're not always the most driven, the most ethical, the perfect person for the job. But we have tried to find people who are aligned with us. Our first and overriding goal is to love others as ourself. That would be loving our investors, loving our staff, loving our operators, our vendors, loving them, as we would like to be loved. And then we have other values below that, that kind of come under that. And so we're looking for people with a similar mindset.
I love that. And I know that you're a spiritual person and you've built your company off of sound, fundamental biblical principles, and they work.
Right. It's really true. Year in and year out, even if they don't look like they're working at the moment, over time, we find out again and again that they do.
It's amazing. You and I are involved in some of the same philanthropies as well, speaking of biblical principles. And I can't thank you enough for introducing me to AIM and that team. It's been an amazing experience and a great cause. Would you care to take a moment and talk about some of the things that are near and dear to your heart, perhaps outside of Wellings and what you're doing there and possibly create awareness for the rest of us?
Yeah, we have several things we're really passionate about. Some of mine are just like personal projects, but I'd love to talk about AIM for a minute. William Wilberforce was a contemporary of George Washington. He was across the pond. And I bet most of the listeners have never heard of him. I highly recommend you go look him up because he deserves to be one of the most famous people. I mean, literally on a very short list of the most famous people in history. I'll summarize his life by saying he reformed English culture somehow. He and his small group of friends literally reformed English culture and made it, the the respectable society it became from a very brutish society. This was 200 to 225 years ago, mainly, is when he was in the House of Commons. But he gave up his wealth, he gave up his reputation, he gave up his friendships and everything to do everything he could to get slavery outlawed in the UK. And he was able to do that 3 days before his death in, I believe it was 1833. And it spilled over to America, of course, and our abolition of slavery. But it's tragic to tell you this if you're listening, but there are now more slaves in the world than ever before. There are 49.6 million estimated enslaved individuals in the world. And since Matt and I started this conversation, hundreds and hundreds of children have been trapped or enslaved or sold into slavery. And it's amazing that if you took the record profits, not the average, the record profits of ExxonMobil, Nike, and Walmart, added those record profits together and tripled that number, that's the U.S. State Department's estimated annual profits from human trafficking. And it's happening right under our nose. So we decided, and Matt, you decided, we wanted to do something about it. And I'm so glad that we have, and our partner AIM at aimfree.org does a fantastic job rescuing and bringing safety and a new life to lots of little children.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just terrific, some of the atrocities that are going on out there. And I'm blessed to have met you and for you to introduce me to AIM. And I think they're doing just wonderful things. And we'll obviously share the link within this broadcast for anybody who wants to learn more about
good.
It. Right. You're a good man for doing all the things that you do. I know you do matches and all kinds of other things to raise capital to stop some of these horrific things that are going on around, you know.
Thanks for saying that. And thank you for being part of the match. And certainly one of our most influential donors.
It's my pleasure. Least I could do. I wanted to go back to something that you said about selecting in 2024. It really sticks out to me. You selected less than 1% of sponsors that kind of came in your lexicon that you underwrote. And there's an interesting book that I wrote. It's called The 80-20 Principle. And it was by an Italian philosopher by the name of Wilfredo Pareto. And basically, I'm not sure if you read the book, I'm sure you're very familiar with the concept, but it states that 20% out of 80% of things you do, basically 20% of them yield all the results. And then if you broke that down even further, so I guess what I'm getting at here is you pick the best in class sponsors. If you were to go even a level deeper after you've picked the best in class sponsors, from those one or two, three sponsors that are at the top of the list, how much NOI or profitability did those best in class provide to Wellings compared to the others?
Well, you know, your listeners will be surprised that we didn't talk about this beforehand because it sounds like you're setting me up. But this is a Pareto graph.
Okay.
The 80-20 rule is not, it's not a line. It's a skew curve up and to the right, if you can't see this. And what it says is the average investor, this is my words, by the way, not Pareto, although he may have said something similar. The average investor will pick the average operator who will do the average deal and they'll get average results. Mm-hmm. And from 2012 to 2022, average was amazing. Why? Because the rising tide lifted all boats. Yep. And all types of lucky amateurs who took much bigger risks than you and I made much more profits because when the rising tide's going up, 80% leverage pays investors better than 50% leverage on the same deal. But Warren Buffett said, someday that tide will go out and then we'll see who's skinny dipping. Now, we saw that years ago and we said, hey, the 80-20 rule, to your point, Matt, is fractal. That means if you take the top 20% of operators, you'll get the best results. But if you take the top 20% of the top 20%,
right,
you'll get even better results. And in my mind, better results means much safer, way higher than the, you know, way above the waterline. When I'm mixing metaphors here, but when the tide goes out, they're way, way safe. But not only are they safe, they're providing much better profits. And I don't have a numerical answer for you about how that worked out for us in the last couple of years in our funds. But I can tell you that certain operators we've invested with have provided returns that are much, much safer than the average and much, much better than the average. And that's what we love about you.
Well, I'm just so thankful to be included in that list. And the reason I asked the question was not to set you up. It's because we've recognized the same phenomenon in our investments. We are not a fund to fund. Obviously, we're an operator. But if you take a look at our entire portfolio, usually what happens is we have properties that perform exactly as we expect. We have those properties that perform perhaps slightly below what we expect. And then we have a handful of properties that we've just hit an absolute grand slam on.
Right.
And that's part of the beauty, back to the diversification concept that you brought up, of being in a fund structure.
Right.
You're in a fund structure versus a syndication. All your eggs aren't in one basket where you're going to live or die based off one investment. When right. you take those grand slams, some triples, doubles, and singles, and you strike out once or twice, when you look at the aggregate around the entire fund, it really picks up that performance in a major way. And that's how we've always been able to outperform and deliver returns in excess to yeah. where we've promised our investors. Typically, we're underwriting, and we tell our investors 15 to 20% IRR. Historically, it's been well in excess of that. And I know right. your performance and your results have been exceptional as well. So I was just wondering if that same phenomenon on the operator side also applies to the fund to fund model side.
Yeah, it does. We're always looking. I mean, like we like to say that we're trying to get the top 20 of the top 20%. Now, I wouldn't say that just because we picked 0.66% last year that we absolutely were able to do that. The proof will be in 5 or 10 years if it really plays out that way. But that's our goal, is to find those operators who, like you, are way over here on the curve. And by doing that, be much safer, much more profitable. And, you know, hopefully when we get those lemon deals that, you know, you can't predict everything. You can't control everything. You can't control a pandemic. You can't control interest rates. When we get something that does go south, you know, hopefully it'll be washed out with these great deals.
Yeah. And what's your outlook for the future? You know, here we are in 2025, a new administration, a lot of uncertainty in the markets around tariffs and trade wars, a lot of interesting things swirling around us with inflation. I'd love to get your take and your view of the broader macro economy, but probably even more importantly, our two asset classes and how you think they'll perform moving forward in this environment.
Yeah, you know, I get this question a lot. You know, people will say on a podcast, well, self-storage is obviously overbuilt. You know, you wrote a book on self-storage in 2021. That's when it was really peaking. But by 2023, it was obviously in a blah, blah, blah. And I say, you know, my friend Matt finds, and then I'll generically tell them like three of the deals you found. You know, like my friend Matt bought a, you know, 700 unit self-storage in a 12,000 person town in Texas and was able to blah, blah, blah. And another one, you know, it had a lot of homeless people in it, which was unsafe and illegal. And once he evicted, you know, I mean, blah, blah, blah. When we find deals like that consistently, when you have 5 or 10 people sitting in a room, calling, texting, emailing, messaging mom and pop operators month in, month out, year in, year out, you're going to find deals where it doesn't really matter completely what the economy's doing. Warren and Charlie claim that in 50 or so years of investing together, they never had a significant conversation about the economy when making an investment or a divestment. They looked at the fundamentals, and I want to believe that we're thinking the same way. So I commend you guys on continuing to buy self-storage when other people were running from it. And anybody who knows about mobile home parks knows that it's the one asset type that I know of, at least, that has a shrinking supply and an increasing demand every year. There really is an affordable housing crisis. It's getting much worse. And mobile home parks generally provide a wonderful place to live for people at a way below, way lower cost than other options. And, but with the shrinking supply and the increasing demand and something like 40 to 44,000 mom and pop owned assets out there, it really is a wonderful place to invest in. I would dare say, if you get the right deal, in any economy.
Yeah. I always say it's really hard to get hurt in both asset classes, but it's even harder to get hurt in mobile home communities, especially if you know how to buy right and you're a good operator.
Right.
And I can't agree with you more with the affordable housing crisis. I mean, it's become a major issue. And, you know, think about those dynamics that you just mentioned, this shrinking supply and an ever growing and an exploding demand. It gives operators tremendous pricing power, tremendous ability to fill vacant sites. And I could attest and tell you, at no point in our history have we filled vacancies in our mobile home parks like we are today. And it's really exciting because we don't underwrite much occupancy growth, but yeah, we are hitting it. And I think that's what makes this asset class so exciting, especially in a down market. You know, you mentioned that you guys are really focused on recession-resistant asset classes, and I really think that you picked the best two. To be completely honest with you.
Well, I do too. I mean, did you hear that 10,000 people turned 65 today and yesterday and tomorrow? No. And guess what? 6 in 10 of them don't have $10,000 saved for retirement, but many of them have some home equity and the ability to afford a mobile home.
Well, and I think it's tremendous for us to be in the position that we're in, where we could provide them a piece of the American dream, where if it weren't for these circumstances and these investments that we're in and our efforts and our team's efforts, they wouldn't have that option. So right. I think it's a win-win all around. It's a win for us, it's a win for our investors, and it's a win for the residents within our communities that we can provide a home for. So it's
absolutely
very fulfilling. Well, let me ask you this question. Somebody that's aspiring to be you, and to have a fund of funds of their own at some point, and to be an influencer and to give back, to have a wonderful marriage for 38 years. What kind of advice, what would be the biggest piece of advice, I should say, that you would give them?
No one's ever asked me that question. And I don't know exactly how to answer it. But I really believe, to be totally honest with you, I really believe that we were created just like a car was created to have fuel or it wouldn't run, whether it's a Tesla on electric or whether it's gasoline. I really believe in the same way we were created to have a relationship with God, or things aren't going to work out for us. And I mean, it doesn't mean you can't have a good life. We were all made in the image of God, and we can have a great life. But if you really want to have the very best life that you were created to have, I would say, you know, go find a relationship with your creator first. That's my honest answer.
I think it's a simple, but I mean, there's nothing more succinct of an answer. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that answer, and I'm sure people listening will as well. But with that, I got to tell you, this has been really fun. I've enjoyed it. I hope it's the first of many, and you're an amazing friend, and thank you so much for being a part of Crystal View and my family and being a friend of mine. I can't thank you enough, Paul.
Matt, it's such an honor to invest with you and to know you and to be in this relationship these last almost 7 years and hopefully for many, many more.
Absolutely. We're just scratching the surface. We're going to have a good time over the next 10, 20 years together.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you didn't ask me this, and maybe there was a reason you didn't, but I'm going to say it. Of the 175 million or so we've invested about a third of that, even though we have 20 some operators, about a third of it with you, Matt. And if it wasn't for our investment committee, as you know, we would have invested even more. Our investment committee, one guy is a former hedge fund manager, and he really believes you should only have something like 2 or 3% at most in any operator. And he's looking at us going, wait a minute, you've got 30 what percent in with Crystal View? And we said, it makes sense. Trust us. Look at the track record. Look at their performance. Look at how other people have messed up and they have it. And he and the other guy on the, we have two outside parties and then me on the investment committee. And so they outvoted me, but we're going to replace them soon. And I'm just kidding, but seriously.
You got my vote. Yeah. No.
No, we love you guys and we can't thank you enough. And I can tell my wife, you know, hey, look, Matt and his team are one of the reasons we're going to have more to give to AIM, and we're going to have more to more money in our retirement, and our investors are going to wildly succeed more than ever if we had not met you.
Well, I don't even know what to say to that. It's humbling to hear those words. I'm tremendously grateful for the relationship and the things that you're saying right now. And it's amazing how it goes full cycle. You know, when you do well for people, back to your culture, love your investors, love your employees and your staff, and it's going to come back. I feel the same way. When you do the right things and you honor certain principles and you do well and you give back, it's a virtuous cycle. Yeah. And once you build momentum in life, it's like compound interest and compound gains. The last thing you want to do is slow down that compounding machine in all areas, in business and life and love. It's all about letting things compound and grow and grow. And yeah. It's just a pleasure and a blessing to be associated with you, a part of that journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it is for me too. Thank you so much, Matt. I got more stuff that's hitting my brain to say, but I know we've gone over on time. So thank you for the opportunity to say hi today.
Well, absolutely. And that's fine. We'll have to have a sequel.
Okay, let's do it.